Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the February 16th meeting of the conference. No, 15th meeting of the.
What is it?
16th.
The 16th. I was right to begin with. The 16th meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. In case of emergency, there are exits at the back of the room to my right and to the front of the room to my left. If there should be a fire, please don't use the elevator. I wonder if you'd please stand with me as we pledge allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. May we have the roll call, please?
Ms. Chalk?
I'm here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Mr. John?
Here.
Ms. Kellis?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer? Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Mr. Morey?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Sigler has asked to be excused. Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
12 members present.
We have quorum. There will be an executive session at the end of the meeting to discuss collective bargaining negotiations and a personnel issue. Go to privilege of the floor. This is the opportunity that the public has to speak to the county legislature for up to 3 minutes. If someone wants to speak, we ask that you please sign a blue card in the back of the room and hand it up. By signing the card, you're agreeing to a three-minute time limit. You're agreeing not to raise your voice. You're agreeing not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language, or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of peace. You agree not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, you agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. Transferring time to another person is not permitted. And you agree that if you cause a disruption and are asked to leave, you will leave the chambers. We do have a clock on the wall on to my left over there that will count down the time. At the end, there's an audible ring like a telephone, and if you're still speaking then, we ask you please to conclude. I have one blue card at this point. Victor Tiffany.
Victor Tiffany, Danby. I wanted to come back and speak to the resolution passed on the TPP. I want to offer two words to the 11 legislators with the common sense to vote yes on the resolution. Thank you. And three words for the three legislators who voted no. Shame on you. Peter, you once told me that as a secular man, the Constitution is as close to a sacred document as you have in your life. Your no vote conveyed that you essentially used it to blow your nose. Mike's not here, but for the record, if he really wants corporate rule, he should just call IBM and have them send a representative down, and they could sit in his seat. And Jim, to his credit, Jim and exchanged in email exchange in the aftermath of the vote, and I respect that. I truly do. I have a lot of regard for that. It gave me an opportunity to invite him to one of the Sunday TPP conference calls I've been participating in for about a year now. The topic for that call was regulatory coherence. Remember that phrase from last spring? I made it a point this really is a local issue. So I already knew that if the TPP goes through and you want to pass a law to regulate corporate behavior, you're going to have to do expensive and time-consuming cost-benefit analysis. And you cannot use qualitative data. dollars and cents cost benefit. I didn't know you're also going to have to do a trade interference report. Does your law interfere with the Trans-Pacific Partnership? And if that's bad, not bad enough, I also found out that the federal agency in charge of regulatory coherence will have the power to examine your law if you pass a law under the post-TPP, should it pass Congress. They'll have the right to take it off the books, eliminate it. Who needs the 10th Amendment, right, Peter? So once again, I thank you for the wise vote, and hopefully this will send a message to Congress, and they will not pass this uber-fascistic trade agreement. It's a treaty. I want to leave you with all the public policy concerns that really corporations should be addressing. This is the list.
Thank you. That's the only card I have. I've not seen a municipal official. I've missed them before. Anyone out there? So there's no municipal official to speak tonight. I'm privileged of the floor. We'll go to legislators next. Who'd like to speak? Not seeing anybody? Well, no, Carol.
No, I don't. I just want to mention a news report that I saw. It's not about an issue that's here at this point, but that illustrates the complexity of figuring out how we deal with how many environmental and public health threats there may be out there, and the complexity of figuring out how to deal with them. It's about the Zika virus. Apparently, this is a virus that is of great concern, particularly if you're pregnant and either living in Latin America or some other places in the world, or have traveled or will travel there. And the world, the United States is going to ramp up aid, and the world is rushing to kill mosquitoes because the virus is carried by mosquitoes. There are now the chemical that's used to kill those mosquitoes is, I can't pronounce the name of it,
Pyrethrin.
And it's made by Monsanto, and it is a chemical that's been used fairly heavily in some of the regions in which there have been these mosquitoes for years. There are now two reports from two separate countries. A group of health professionals in Brazil, and one with a well-known group in Argentina, a report that came out. And what the reports say is that there is a potential heavy correlation between microcephaly, which is what we think is the problem that's created by the Zika virus for people who are pregnant, and use of this chemical. The report goes into great detail. On the basis of this report, there's a state at one end of Brazil, north or south, I can't remember, that has now said, look, we just don't know enough now, and we're going to ban the use of this chemical, at least until we have a chance to study the correlation. So the concern is that the virus has been prevalent in Latin America, and particularly in Brazil, for decades. Up to 70% of the population in the most heavily affected areas have the Zika virus or have had it. Test positive for having had it. And until 18 months ago, pregnancies were never affected. The use of this particular chemical in those areas was started around the same time period. So under that concern, the use of the chemical has been banned. Other health officials, however, and environmental officials are stepping up to say, you know, look, we've got to ramp up the use of this chemical. I just thought I'd raise that, you know, in light of what we're hearing from Flint and Hoosick Falls and all of the places in which the propensity is to say the way we've been doing it is okay and we trust the, standards. Part of this that I neglected to say is that the Monsanto cites the EPA. The U.S. EPA and the fact that the level of the chemical that they're using is below EPA standards. But, of course, Zika has never been present in the United States. So it's to use that as the guide is probably not appropriate in this case. So I'm just, in a non-threatening way, hopefully, raising the issue that there's an awful lot we don't know in environmental, chemical-related and public health fields that can come to light and has been coming to light in recent months, and whatever lessons we can take about using our utmost caution to as we proceed when questions do come up, and err on the side of caution rather than defense of the status quo is one that I would urge.
Anna Kellis.
Really quickly, there's an event on Tuesday, February 23rd at Cinemopolis. I think it starts at 7 o'clock. It's on a presentation on the history of municipal drug strategies around the world. And I know that's something that we've been discussing recently in some issues that we've been looking at. Sorry, it starts at 6 o'clock. So I just wanted to let everybody know that was happening.
Jim Dennis.
If anyone wants my tickets to the Olympics, see me after the meeting.
Are you pregnant?
Will Burbank.
Thank you, Mike. I assume everybody is familiar with the program Capital Press Room, who covers a lot of topics of interest to the state. I heard one last week that I thought was particularly interesting, which was on about the need for looking at the impact of industrial level solar installations. And this is presently taking place down in Delaware County. But there are a lot of issues that had not occurred to me in terms of the effects on landowners and neighbors and what one should do in negotiating with the companies. Apparently, there are now companies going out going to rural landowners and getting them assigned leases that are in some ways analogous to what was happening with the fracking land people. And
who was the interviewer?
So the interviewee was
Scott Denton.
Chris Denton and Bob Williams. And so I found an interesting show, and it's all in their archive. Go to Capital Press Room.
Martha Robertson.
Yeah, I know the names came up with landowner coalitions on fracking. But, you know, the point being, if you're going to sign a lease, it's good to consult a lawyer on any of these things. I just wanted to mention, I certainly hope all the public who usually comes to see us and speak to us are listening on television tonight, because I'm glad that Ed and Megan are here to talk about the housing survey, and that, of course, Carl's going to make a presentation on TC3. I just want to mention that next Thursday, the 25th, at I believe it is 6 o'clock, there's a meeting of Black Lives Matter, local Black Lives Matter, at the Borgorn Room of the Library. So that's just one upcoming meeting that I've been following. Thanks.
Okay, anyone else? Anyone else before we come back to Carol? Carol.
I was in Arizona last week, and there were barely any solar panels. I returned to my issue of Rolling Stone magazine, which the new issue has an article, Will, and others, that I hope you'll see about policy. They go into a long thing about Florida, but they also mention Arizona Colorado and several other states, and the systematic campaign by Americans for Prosperity, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, funded by the Koch brothers to discredit wind that succeeded in those states. Solar in those states. So I think we have to start being really, really careful about the sources of information because there are scientists being paid and studies. Just make sure that we're using peer-reviewed sources, whatever our arguments are.
Will Burbank.
Sorry to prolong this. This was not about the attributes of solar power at all. This was about essentially issues and things to consider when signing lease. It was highly informative, and I would encourage anybody that has remote interest to give it a listen with an open mind.
Okay. Ready to move on? We have a special topical presentation tonight, which is going to be Carl Haynes, president of our college. After him, we will do the presentations that Martha mentioned from Megan McDonald and Jay Franklin. And I think right before that, we probably will take up the college's resolutions. Carl, President Carl Haynes, welcome. Please don't bang your knee.
Can you hear me okay? Is this mic on? I guess it is.
Welcome.
So, pardon me? Use this one. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for making time on your agenda this evening for my State of the College report, and apologize for being a bit late. Took me almost an hour to get here with the roads out there. There was an accident on 13 South coming in, so there was a lot of delay out there. So in any event, coming around is my brochure version of my State of the College report, or my annual report, really, to the College Board of Trustees and to the college community. I do have more copies here, by the way, if I didn't send enough around, and I'll leave those over here by the... Do you need more?
Another one would be nice.
Okay. I'm going to kind of walk through and highlight each of the major sections of the report and then have a few items that really aren't covered in the report that I'll comment on by way of update. And I know on your agenda tonight is the resolution supporting our base aid request, and I could be happy to answer any questions about that you may have. This is the first time that my annual report also include for the college also includes the annual report for our foundation. You'll see that as a kind of an insert right in the middle. We did that because, you know, there's a considerable amount of crossover between, you know, the actions of our foundation and the achievements of the college. Plus, for obvious reasons, it's a bit of a cost-saving kind of thing for us as well. So it's the first time we've done this, and if you got suggestions or comments on that would be welcome, of course. The first section I want to draw your attention to is the page that shows Bruce Need. He's probably familiar to many of you here in the community, navigating developmental classes. This is a wonderful illustration, I think, of a lot of entrepreneurial activity underway in and among our faculty at the college. Bruce led an initiative that brings together students who are not ready for English 101, but yet not as deficient as to only need, we'll say, that most basic developmental course. And it was an experiment to bring these students together in one class so that they're co-enrolled in both courses at the same time. And I won't get into all the instructional kinds of elements that he's incorporated there, but it has worked very well. It started off as a pilot about 2 years ago, and now it's become a mainstream part of what we're doing to address the developmental needs of our students and accelerating their progress through the completion of English 101, which is so fundamental to many other courses that the students will need following that. And as you can see, the highlight in the headline there talks about the success rate that he's had of the students that complete English 101 at 75% level, after English 100 in this case, at the 75% level. So there's more about that. But that success that he has brought about in English is now moving ahead in our math faculty and our reading faculty, and we're going to be launching similar kinds of initiatives in the developmental and credit-bearing courses in math and reading as we go into the next fall semester. So, so we're very encouraged by that. As you know, it's a core part of our whole mission, which is student success and helping more of our students succeed. The next section is the highlights some of our .biz activities. We're highlighting this year the work we've been doing with the Burn Dairy over in Cortland, just 6 miles north of us where our campus is, a major facility there that's just been built. I would note that when it says Burn Dairy Yogurt, that's not a typo. Okay, that's the way they spell yogurt. So I just wanted to highlight that. But it does, if you read the script there in terms of the president and their HR director at Burn Dairy, how they have appreciated the kind of flexibility we've brought about in terms of delivering the training programs that they needed both during the startup phase of their operation there and then, of course, ongoing as they needed additional kinds of training and staggering the training for their shifts and that sort of thing. So, again, a note there that we had over almost 2,000, 1,900 and some participants in corporate training kinds of programs for our clients. And I just want to highlight, of course, Martha Hubbard. Many of you may know Martha. She's been very active here, both in Tompkins County leadership over the years and in Cortland County as well. And she's our director of corporate training and partnerships. And she was recognized by her statewide association as the outstanding experienced continuing education professional this past year by that association for her 20 years of service to us and to that profession and across the community colleges, actually all state SUNY colleges across the state. So very deserved recognition for her. The next section on the global initiatives, we continue to excel in that regard. We have our regional students from probably 50 or 60 different countries, as well as our special partnerships with our Global Connections program, our language institutes that we offer primarily during the summer, a growing number of students participating in study abroad. And all of what we do here, I think you recognize, helps our students be prepared for the increasingly cultural diversity in our broader community, our broader region. And it's so important if they're going to be prepared to work with people from other cultures to have experience studying and learning and getting to know students from other cultures. And study abroad cases experiencing those cultures. Also, as you know, it's a good revenue source for the college as well. So I don't want to underscore that. I want to underscore that as well. The we'll flip through this brochure on the foundations, but it highlights the scholarships, of course, that our foundation supports, the professional development that it supports. There's a fair amount of support that the foundation provides to the college so that we can then in turn support faculty and staff to participate in professional development activities, conferences, seminars, and that sort of thing. A list of our directors, half from Tompkins, half from Cortland, and we have one director from Tioga County. And then the foundation budget and the college budget on the insert there as well. So the anyway, I'd be happy to answer questions on anything regarding our foundation as well when we during the Q&A session here. Student life, a lot of activities that are underway with student engagement and a mentoring program. I'm always proud to highlight that our athletes have a higher GPA average than our regular student body. It really does underscore that they're student athletes, they're students first. And a broad range of community engagement there with students involved in a number of programs that raise funds to support cancer services in both counties various other activities. And the little in the bottom right-hand corner, I want to make sure you note that 80% of our students graduating complete related to their academic program and career jobs, and 67% of those remain employed in the Central New York region. The next page highlights a little bit about what some misperceptions, I guess I would say, or myths about student behavior on campus. I'll let you read that on your own without expanding on it too much. But I think you'd be surprised that when they did an in-depth survey of our students regarding use of drugs, use of alcohol, sexual activity, and all that sort of thing, it does not support the myths that we all might have that it's rampant on college campuses, or at least on our campus around at all. And I'll let you read that on your own. But it's I think the only thing that was underscored as being true is that students don't get enough sleep. Other than that, most of the other myths were unfounded. The nice picture there that highlights the Capital Project that just wrapped up last year with our new Enrollment Service Center. For those of you who've been on campus, you've probably seen that, but it's bringing together all of our enrollment services of advisement, registration, admissions, financial aid, the testing services, all into one area so that students can receive those services without having to run all over different parts of the campus. The child care, the next page, you will be hearing more about that from us. Our foundation supported the design for a new child care center that we'd like to build on campus. The picture there shows a rendering of that building, and we really have a significant demand for child care, primarily from students, and oftentimes students who get pregnant while they're at the college need to drop out because of the lack of child care, because we didn't have infant care. People who have oftentimes will get questions. People on a return and need to come back to college for whatever reasons. One of the first questions they're asking, do we have child care? And if we don't, or if it's not available, then they don't even go to the admissions process. So it's something that I think we need have had a need to really address. So this center will include services for infants from 6 weeks old all the way up to the preschool age group. There'll be a separate wing. You can sort of see that characterized in the schematic there. And for each of those age groups, with a separate playground or play area for the age-appropriate groups. And it'll actually more than double the capacity that we have right now to serve children. And now the funding of this, we will be coming to you to ask for support for a resolution that we want to send to the state for their 50% share. The one thing I won't have to do is to ask for any financial support, because we received a very generous donation from Arthur Kukas of $2 million to support the local cash match for that. So there won't be any need to either A, access taxpayer resources, or even to borrow, if you borrow money for us, okay, which sometimes has been a requirement because of the cash flow aspects of having to having to pay first before we get the state money back from us. So, but we will still be doing, even with that, we're still going to be doing a fundraising campaign that'll be launched in June for $1 million, primarily to help support build an endowment to help support and the operation of the child care center, because it is expensive, particularly the infant care, and we're going to need we want to keep the rates for the students as low as we possibly can. So we'll be coming back with a formal proposal when we come through the budget process, but I just want you to be aware of that. By the way, the building will be located, you're familiar with our campus, of course, where the new Enrollment Service Center is, right on that front corner, front west corner of the building. There's a big lawn area there between that building and the pond. So the child care center will overlook the pond right in that area and obviously be right close to the road, so it'll be easy for families to either drop off their children there and or for the bus to stop there and drop the children off and their parents. I think that's about it. I got a few other miscellaneous things I'll just kind of touch on, and then I'd be happy to answer questions on anything that you have. I heard all the discussions on solar, and frankly, I didn't quite hear it all, unfortunately. But I can say that our solar array is doing well, and actually this first year provided 97% of the energy on the campus, which was more than actually we originally anticipated it would do. Our Farm to Bistro initiative is doing well. We just kind of finished our startup year, which, had the usual kind of bumps and grinds of any kind of a startup with any initiative of this scope. But we're now moving into the third year with our farm. So it's really their first year of having everything really ready to go into full production with their greenhouses and hoop houses and all that. So I was talking with the director there today. He's all excited about that. We have a new emerging scholars program that we're now recruiting for. This is a program, as I think you probably are aware, we have rapidly increased the diversity of our student body, and we've been unable to stay up with the diversity of our faculty, okay, at the college. Real gap. And in spite of various kinds of initiatives we've had over a couple of decades, okay, we've never been able to really make meaningful progress in that regard. So this is a program where we are really literally hoping to recruit our own students into faculty positions. And without getting into all the details of it, I could ask questions, of course, but for students who have graduated from TC3, and who have part of the relationship with the faculty, have an interest in wanting to teach because we know them and we know their commitment to our college and the community and so on, and who are within 15 credits of completing their baccalaureate degree, are eligible to apply. And if they're accepted this year we have funds to fund two what we call emerging scholars that will begin in the fall, this fall. It'll provide a $13,000 scholarship each year for 2 years as they complete their master's degree. In addition, they'll be given $3,000 a semester to be working as a part of a course assignment with a faculty mentor. They won't be on their own with a course, but they'll be working with a faculty. And they'll be provided a couple thousand dollars each year to do professional development under the direction of their faculty mentor. We now have funds this year to fund two emerging scholars starting this fall, and then after 2 years we have funds to do two more. So our goal has been 4 years to have, and by the way, at the end of that 2 year period, they'll become a full fledged member of our faculty. The scholarship will be given to them in the form of a no interest loan, and so as long as they provide us with at least 2 years of service at the end of that, when they begin their teaching faculty role, then the loan will be forgiven. If they leave us before that, then they owe some portion of that money back to us. We're pretty excited about that. At the end of 4 years, we hope to have four faculty that will be of either African-American, Hispanic background that will be serving on our faculty in some capacity in one of our discipline areas.
Carl, could you mention where the funding for that program
is? I'm sorry. I should have mentioned that along the way. But, again, the funds for that are coming from a little part of the endowment that Arthur Kukas has provided us at the college. So I keep mentioning Arthur Kukas, but he's been a very significant donor, as you all know. So there's private money. There's private funds that are supporting that initiative, and, again, through his generosity. You'll be hearing more about this next year, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of a heads up that we're right in the middle of moving forward with four strategic priorities at the college to address both primarily enrollment. Okay, as you know, 85% of our revenue comes directly related to our enrollment. And enrollment for the last 4 years in a row has been declining as it has at most other community colleges around the country for various reasons. This year, by the way, I can say that this semester we did a little bit better than budget. We budgeted to be down 3.4%, I think, and we did a little bit better than that. So we're really on budget, even though it was, we budgeted to be down at 3.4 or whatever. So actually that's a pretty good sign for us. And in the meetings with about my colleagues last week, several were down in the high single digit to low double digit range. But the strategic priorities, last spring I completed a listening tour of the campus. I held 13 different sessions with probably 15 to 20 people each. 85% of our employees attended one of those listening sessions where I really wanted to hear their thoughts, our mission, our vision, what we needed to be doing and what ideas they had in terms of moving forward, what they felt the really major issues were in terms of how we could improve our student success at the campus. Out of those discussions emerged four strategic priorities, and out of those, we went through a whole process this fall of getting people to weigh in on those and wordsmith them in various ways and so on. And then out of that came six different action groups that are meeting now and developing ideas about how we can do things. So the four strategic priorities, just so I don't misquote them, but the first one is the first semester matters. We have a tremendous amount of evidence and research around the country that if students don't succeed in that first semester, they're just plain not going to make it at all. Ongoing support for students, particularly high-risk groups, students that are come from low-income families, various kind of ethnic backgrounds. There's a couple of the criteria that we have there that are high-risk. Marketing, and we're ramping up a whole new marketing campaign, and then increased evidence of evidence-based data-driven decision-making and so on. We're ramping up some efforts in that regard. So anyway, more about that to come as we move forward with those initiatives. And we will be going through our reaccreditation process with the Middle States in the spring of 2018. Sounds like a long ways away, 2 years away. But the self-study process actually starts right now. And we now have organized our committees on campus. They're just beginning to do their work. And that is a lot of work over the next 18 months before we submit our self-study report in December of 17. And then in the spring of 18, a team visit from the Middle States Commission will come, and we have confidence we'll reaccreditate the college. So that's my highlights. If there's something that you want to know about the college that I haven't touched on in one way or another in terms of what we're doing or any feedback on anything, I'd be happy to do it. And, of course, answer any questions on the resolution that the Budget Committee acted on.
Yeah, well, let's get your questions first, and then I'll turn to Jim to add those to the agenda and talk about
okay.
those so you can know what happens.
Okay.
Peter Stein.
I had a couple of questions. Just occurred to me, this drop in enrollment, do you think that is connected to the drop in unemployment, that we're becoming more and more a fully employed, full employment, and people that couldn't find a job thought, well, they'll go to TC3 and learn something there, but now they can find jobs so they don't go to TC3. I just wondered if that has been...
Historically... that has been true. Our enrollment has always been countercyclical to how the economy is doing. I do think, and I have this belief, that it's more than that this year, this time around. Okay, even though the economy does seem to be improving, there are other factors that seem to be in play. that I think is impacting enrollment, particularly in the community college level. I'll mention two others other than the one that you just mentioned. One is the increased level of media focus on the value of higher education. You're seeing more and more articles, it seems, all the time about questioning whether or not, you know, getting a college degree is really worth it. And, of course, they're always citing, you know, the people that wind up with six-figure debt, okay, as being, you know, the examples, okay, somebody with a PhD driving a taxi cab or whatever. But, you know, it. So anyway, that whittles down to people that, you know, maybe really on that bubble of whether they really, you know, they're medium or low income. Do they really want to go out and borrow some money to help their child, you know, go to a community college? And oftentimes they're making that choice not to, okay, or to delay that decision. And as a result of that dynamic, you are seeing, I'll say this about the state university colleges in particular, but I think it's occurring in other parts of the country as well, where they make their classes. Okay, so I'll let you figure out how they do it. Okay, but basically, there's students that probably 5 years ago would have been on our campus that are now at SUNY Cortland, Geneseo, Oneonta, Oswego, or someplace else. So that level of competition is increased significantly.
Okay, I had another question.
Sure.
The first thing you talked about mixing classes of people.
Oh yeah, the developmental and credit-bearing course.
And everybody does better as a result of that.
Well, not everybody. I didn't
well,
say that.
Not everybody,
okay.
But many people do better, okay?
Yeah, but there's improvement.
I just wondered about that because in all the education that I've had and given, it was always, I always thought of it as a building process. That's how it was sold. I went into kindergarten and then learned enough how to do grade school, and then I went to college, and I went to graduate school, and it was always building on what I had learned in the previous time. Mm-hmm. And the sense that, well, you can't start with graduate school because you have to learn all the other things up till then. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if I hadn't had an undergraduate education, you put me in graduate school education, I'd fail, okay? Mm-hmm. So it sounds somehow counterintuitive that that isn't true for the education that you do in TC3, because people who aren't trained do as well as the people who are trained, which is what you say, okay?
I think it's still true at TC3, okay, the point you're making, the building block notion. The difference is in the pedagogy and the instructional environment that's created in that that particular set of courses. Let me draw two extremes, okay? You know, a student who really tests as having extraordinarily poor writing skills, they need that developmental course, and that's where they will be because they need that building block to get to the next level. However, a lot of students don't need a whole semester of that developmental writing. Their writing didn't test as being tested sufficiently deficient, okay, to not necessarily go directly into a credit-bearing English class, but on the other hand, it probably wasn't enough that they needed a whole semester. So what Bruce has done is he brings those students together into one class. They get credit for two different courses, okay? So he's really teaching two different courses simultaneously. So I'm not exactly sure how he manages the classroom experience, to be honest, but he manages it in such a way that the students are really picking up on those skills that they need during that semester and also moving and completing the credit-bearing requirements for the English 100 course as well. So it really is doing exactly what you're suggesting, but it's a dynamic and an instructional method that has proven to be unique. Bruce learned about it, by the way, at a conference he was at, so it isn't anything that he invented, okay? It's some other colleges around the country that have been working with this concept, and it's proven to be very successful. But it's very much in harmony with what you're the approach that you're your experience, okay, is just it's a different kind of dynamic with this particular group of students that need developmental help, but they can get that help while they're completing a credit-bearing English course. And what that allows them to do is to accelerate into their curriculum without having to, you know, be behind a whole semester.
Okay, thank you. And before I give up, I want to tell you that my wife and I went to Valentine's Day at your restaurant.
Cultivator.
We had a delicious meal and enjoyed it very much. So thank you.
Glad to hear that. Glad to hear that.
Okay, let's remember it's been snowing out, so let's kind of keep everybody moving along here. Martha?
Thanks, Carl. This is really nice. And, of course, I'm, as you know, very excited about the child care center. Can I ask two questions? Do you know how many campuses around the state have similar programs? And what kind of mix of faculty, students, and staff are among the kids, among the families?
Yeah. The first question, okay, I think several of the community colleges over the years have had child care centers. It's interesting that in the last year or two in particular, at least I know of two campuses, and I think there's more from what I've been hearing secondhand, okay, that have closed their child care centers.
Closed them.
For financial reasons. As you know, our child care center works under the Faculty Student Association corporate entity, okay? It's not under the college's budget, so to speak. And I know that in at least a couple of those centers where they have closed, okay, the center was functioned under the college budget more so than the faculty student budget. But anyway, so some recently have closed for various kinds of financial reasons. We were among the first, by the way, okay, way back in the early 70s, we had maybe one of the first two or three child care centers on campus of any of the SUNY colleges. In any given semester, probably 90%, sometimes more, of the children would be children of students. We have maybe, I can think of at least maybe four, five, six parents that are employees that have their children there, for example, this semester. That varies as time goes on, but I would say on average 90% plus are children. Let me say that 90% plus are children of students. We do have from time to time a handful of people from the community that take advantage of that as well, but that's only on a space available basis.
Thank you.
Anna?
Hi,
Anna.
No, we've spoken recently, and so I've finally got an understanding of the base of what you're offering and really appreciated it. It's really amazing. So just a few questions. To counter the decline that you're seeing, I remember speaking with you about how some state and private universities are digging deeper into their pool, which then is affecting community colleges, which was very eloquently said. Are you exploring online options as a way to counter that? Online education, of course, a lot of people working. It provides a lot more flexibility time-wise. So
we were actually on the front end of that, actually almost 20 years ago. In the mid-90s, we started with our online instruction program. And we were literally, I'm probably one of the first of about eight or nine of the community colleges, and maybe there's one or two state ops in there, that was began offering online education. And probably... don't quote me on this, but I'm going to be not too far off. About 10% of our full-time equivalent student enrollment base comes directly from online enrollment. And the other interesting thing is that a good share of that are students that live right in our student housing. Okay, it's counterintuitive, okay, but, you know, students are opting for online courses to help make their schedules work for them when they have jobs or when they are involved in student activities or athletics or whatever they're doing, so that they have a more flexible schedule.
Great. Awesome. Another question I had was with the child care center. Are you going to try to explore the possibility of having educational opportunities through the child care center so that people who are taking classes could actually...
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I forgot that, and I shouldn't have, because that's a big part of what we're doing. Okay, we have an early childhood development program. And that is very much integral in terms of what we're doing. When you think in terms of what we're doing with Farm to Bistro, where, you know, all those kind of enterprises, the cultivari and others, are supporting four different academic programs. That's really why we have those enterprises. And it's the same thing with the child care center. Geez, I'm disappointed in myself that I didn't bring that up when I talked about it. That's very much a part of it. As a matter of fact, the center is designed to have cameras and so on all over the place so that whether the students from our child care, our child development program or psychology classes or nursing program, if they want to observe students at the very places around campus, we'll be able to go and see them on video, or, of course, there will be different rooms where they can go into the center and observe the children firsthand. So that's key to what we're doing. Yeah.
Two other, I hope, somewhat short questions. Have you been reaching out to, or do you have, as part of your evidence-based analysis and decision-making process, assessment of students in the community on what changes might be happening, of what's desired to be prepared for the marketplace, what education is desired to drive the new program development and educational opportunities?
I'll say a qualified yes. Not quite the way you've asked it. Okay, we haven't done it quite that way in terms of trying to figure out the career interests of students, if you will. However, we did recently complete a pretty comprehensive marketing research to learn about how the community, our prospective students, current students, business leaders in the community. Some of you may be on a list for that research. But by the way, I'll brag about that for just a moment. I know Mike's in a hurry to get me out of here. But the first part of that survey was done anonymously. They didn't know who was doing the research. And they were asking people to respond to colleges around the region. So it's all the community colleges, four-year colleges, research universities like Cornell, Syracuse University, you know, and the whole Central New York core. We ranked a strong first, okay, in terms of the academic quality of it as our institution, and we were just a smidgen under most of the other four-year campuses that were in the same pool. So we were very proud of that. We have a very strong academic reputation. Now, I said all that, and I didn't answer your question. The other thing that we have been rolling out with the school districts, okay, is what we call Career Coach. It's a software program that it would take a lot more time than we have to explain how it functions, but it really allows a student or anybody in the community. It's on our website. You can go there and access it. Anybody can if they want it. They're doing career exploration, and it helps you. If you got an idea about a career, if I want to be a psychiatrist, what do I have to do? And then it drives you down to how can you start a TC3 to move forward with that career? It might require a bachelor's degree, it might require a master's degree, or whatever. But here's how you can start a TC3 to make that direction. So, that's the career link, helping us to define where new programs come about. That's a smorgasbord of a lot of different things. A good part of it is my role with various economic development boards and workforce boards and all that kind of thing that I serve on in both communities, where all of a sudden you kind of learn about it. You know, biotechnology came up that way. Okay, this Farm to Bistro kind of came up that way. So, you know, you learn, you keep your eyes and ears open, and then you have to test those ideas against, you know, what our admissions people are hearing from prospective students and so on, and then... Then the real test is, you know, are students enrolling, you know. So we have programs we've eliminated recently as well because they lost people who weren't as interested.
I can hold on for my last question.
Yeah, you got another one, did you say?
No, I had, but I'm going to hold off in the interest of time.
Thank you. Let's let Will ask his, and then let's move to the resolutions.
Okay, thank you. Carl, just tell a little more about Cultivari. It's been going for about a year right now, and was that a one-year program for the students, or is it a multiple year, the students that are actually involved with that effort?
The all four degree programs that are a part of the broader Farm to Bistro initiative are two-year degree programs, associate degree programs,
okay,
the culinary arts program being one, the wine marketing being one, restaurant management being another one, which is primarily the management part.
So your students are basically would be halfway through if they've started when...
Yes.
Yeah, so, yep. And are you sensing that there's continuing interest in terms of people applying to it for...
Yeah, I... wine marketing and sustainable farming aren't as strong as the other two. We wish they were a little bit stronger. I think we're doing a lot of. I think in some respects, this in the, to speak to the sustainable farming in particular, and we're doing some marketing on this. Okay, there's kind of impression it's all about farming, and that's only really. I don't want to say a small part, but it's only one part of it, because the jobs from with that degree really are in the whole food system side of things. That's where the jobs are. Okay, the people that might be interested in developing a farm kind of related enterprise, we do have some students that have that kind of goal, but that's not the majority, and that's not where the jobs are. But I don't think we've communicated that as well as we could in terms of recruiting students for that, and we're kind of addressing that. Wine marketing gets a lot of enrollment in the courses, not for the obvious reasons you might think, but I mean, it really is a nice ancillary set of courses for students in the other programs. That becomes a program where we tend to have more people doing career change kinds of things. I even met a lady the other day that's retiring in one of the organizations in town, and that's her retirement career, okay, that she wants to get involved in wine marketing. So there's a lot of interest in that, but we could be happy to have more enrollment in that program.
Thank you.
Julie, I don't want to cut you off. Did you have a question?
I was going to reply to Carl's question. Did we have any suggestions for his glossy annual report? The only thing I would like to see added are page numbers.
You know, when I was coming down here today and preparing, I noticed that. So I'll carry that message back. Thank you.
Jim Dennis, I think you have a couple of resolutions to add.
I do, Michael. The first one is a rescission of resolution number 32 of 2016, support for base aid increase for Tompkins-Cortland Community College, and I would move that.
Is there a second to adding it? Glenn Morey. All in favor of adding that to the agenda, please raise your hand. Those opposed, that's unanimous. And the other one?
And the second one is resolution F. And it is support for base aid increase for Tompkins-Cortland Community College, and I will move that.
Seconded by Dave. All in favor of adding that to the agenda, please raise your hand. Those opposed, that's unanimous. Jim, do you want to move them?
Let me move the rescission first of resolution number 32, support for base aid increase for Tompkins-Cortland Community College, and I will move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave. Jim, do you want to speak to this?
Yes. The last resolution we passed had some language that was put in at the latter part of the discussion, and it's in the sixth whereas, and it the words are as far below the legislative, if anyone looks at the minutes, where it says 40% level of the two sponsoring counties. And if you look at the new resolution that you have, it's changed somewhat from that. It says one-third of TC3's operating costs or 40% of state support allowed for those with full opportunity access that all SUNY Community College, yada, 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 goes on. So we took out the level provided by the two sponsoring counties, and we took that out upon Dr. Haynes' recommendation.
Is there discussion about this? Shall we vote? All those in favor of this resolution, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous.
Do we have to vote on the rescission?
That was the rescission.
Okay, that was, because there is no, all right. And I will move the new resolution F, support for base aid increase for Tompkins-Cortland Community College.
Seconded by Anna Kellis. Discussion? Just puts us back to where we were the last meeting, is that
yes,
right?
With some small changes.
I'll take Peter first, then Carol.
Peter?
What? I just wanted to vote for it.
Oh, we haven't voted. We haven't got there. We're at discussion.
Oh, all right.
Carol?
Well, I certainly support this. The fifth whereas, to me, is the crux of the matter about how much lower the base aid is than it was 5 years ago. The new sixth whereas, although I don't have the other one there to compare it to, I find to be not. I don't understand the replacement. I'm wondering if we needed it at all, whether it wouldn't be easier.
Let me just say the fifth we did not change.
I understand
Let me explain it. We're talking about the sixth because there was some language in there that says 40% level of the two sponsoring counties. And Carl, do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Sure. They really are two different points, even though they're related. I mean, the fifth one that you mentioned, Carol, really is just speaking to the fact that, you know, our base aid rate is $78 less than it was, you know, 5 years ago, okay, which accounts for the fact that within their overall support, state support, is only 25%, whereas, and I cite the education law. I assume that's in your version, I hope. Education law, Article 26, Section Is that
yes.
parenthetically noted? Okay. And that was a part that I, when I went back and looked at this, I added that language to make sure it was clear about where that comes from. We don't just make that up. You often have heard about the one-third, one-third, one-third. Well, we've been so long without even getting to one-third, okay, and we forget about the fact that in that education law, we're supposed to be at 40%. Because every community college in the SUNY system adheres to the requirements to earn 40% of state aid. And yet we aren't getting it. So there was only 1 year back in the 70s, I think, when that actually happened. So that's what that's about. We're just trying to make the point and drive it home as many ways as we possibly can that why do we need this $285? Because we need to get closer to where the education law suggests we should be for our state aid.
So I just found the sentence to be unclear the way it's written. So it. To me, it would be a lot clearer, and I don't think this is a picky editing point, if it read far below a third of TC3's operating costs or the 40% state support allowed for those with full opportunity access.
Yes.
It just is unclear to me the way this sentence reads.
I agree.
It doesn't make any sense.
My suggestion is make a motion.
Okay.
I am not taking friendly amendments.
You wouldn't consider it friendly to where it's
No, I would not.
40%?
I would not.
Out the word of?
I would not.
Carol, do you... Carol,
okay, I'd so move.
All right. Would you please restate what you wanted to say, your amendment?
I want to amend this to add the word the in front of the number 40 and take out the word of after the word percent.
Is there a second?
And I would then read, can I read it to people, how the whole sentence would then read?
Sure.
Whereas state support for community college operating budgets, comma, currently at approximately 25% for Tompkins-Cortland Community College, comma, is far below a third of TC3's operating costs, or the 40% state support allowed for those with full opportunity access that all SUNY community colleges have embraced for decades.
Is there a second for that amendment? Seconded by Dooley. Discussion on the amendment. Dooley?
I had exactly the same problem with the wording, Carol. Thank you for figuring it out.
Can I try reading?
Oh. Well, I have Jim next, and now back to you, Carol. I've got Martha. I'm sorry. I have to pick her up, too.
Please vote it down, the rest of you, if possible. The reason why we're here is because the first resolution got changed during the legislature, and we're back here with one recommended by the president of TC3.
All right, back to Carol.
Can I ask Carl if you would consider this a friendly grammatical change?
I've got a draft that may or may not be the same one you had, but the only word you're adding is the word the?
And I'm taking out the word of.
Where's of?
After 40%.
She's adding the word the before 40%.
Oh, it doesn't make any sense.
I got a word or there. You got an of?
No. It's the word of after the 40%, and the word the would be put in before it.
Of state.
Either that or you'd have to say, and is below the 40% of state support allowed for those with full opportunity. It's just, if I read this sentence without any change.
Yeah.
Let Carl respond.
What we're saying here then is is far below the one-third of our operating costs, or it's also below the 40%. I mean, I added some words there that I think are inferred, okay, for those with full opportunity access that all SUNY community colleges have embraced for decades.
That would be fine, too.
So
the sentence would then make sense to me.
You got the 40% of... Somebody else added the word state in there. I don't have that in my version. I think that got added by your attorney or something or other. But I thought it was, no? Jonathan? All right. Somebody was citing you at least. But I thought it was.
All right.
I didn't, but anyway.
On the amendment, Martha?
I was going to ask Carl. Is this a resolution that other community colleges are using with their counties, and Cortland County doing this, et cetera?
Cortland County's got the same resolution, and they will be acting on it in their meeting on the 25th of this month. I mentioned this at our Community College President's Association meeting last week in Albany, that I was doing this because we have, as I said in the first whereas here, there's a big initiative that the chancellor has for advocacy for all of SUNY, but our community colleges as well. And they all asked me for a copy of this resolution, okay, because they want to do the same thing with their counties. So how many will, I really don't know. But I think that several expressed a real strong interest in wanting to obviously partly do something a little different. I doubt if they're going to take my language in total, but they'll modify it to address their unique circumstance of their college. But I think the idea of trying to get our county sponsors, getting our student body on board, getting our employees responding, we're doing a big letter writing campaign and Survey Monkey kind of thing, and getting out to all of our legislators to get behind us this year.
On the amendment, Anna Kellis.
The only time I have issues with very small changes like this is if they fundamentally change the nature of them. What's being said,
mm-hmm.
And this seems more like a clarification, so I don't have a problem with it.
Carol, do you have any other new information?
Well, can I reframe my amendment to be what Carl suggested? Because the words that he used would also make it clearer. I just think that if we're weighing into the state, that they should support base aid because it's not even at the 40% that they allow. This sentence just doesn't say that the way it reads. It's a very confusing sentence.
We have an amendment on the table.
So I would take it as a friendly amendment to my amendment to have it read the way Carl had it read, which was of TC3's operating costs. And that is also below the 40% of state support.
Julie, is that friendly to you as seconder?
Yes.
All right. So we now have a friendly amendment to the amendment, basically using the language that Carl talked about.
So would that
further discussion on the amendment?
So can I ask if that would now be friendly to the original mover?
It will not.
Peter Stein.
Can I call a question on this amendment?
The question has been called. Is there a second? Seconded by Anna Kellis. All those in favor of calling the question, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That looks like it's unanimous. So we'll move right to the vote on the amendment as proposed by Carol with the friendly amendment with Carl's language.
Can we have that read so we know what we're voting on?
Sure. Have you got it, or we need Carol to read it again?
Whereas state support for community college operating budgets, currently at approximately 25% for Tompkins-Cortland Community College, is far below one-third of TC3's operating costs, and that is also below the 40% of state support allowed for those with full opportunity access that all SUNY community colleges have embraced for decades.
Okay, we're ready to vote on the amendment. All those in favor, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Those opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that carries. So now that we're back to the original motion, which is the one Jim proposed with the amendment, but it just that has just been passed. Are we ready to vote on this? All those in favor of the resolution, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That is unanimous. Jim?
Yes, Carl. In a conversation we had, you had suggested to me that there were some other people, a list of committee chairs and things that we might want to address this to. Is that, could you, or do you want to do that yourself?
Yeah, what I thought the next step would be is once Cortland has approved this as well, that I would work with Kathy probably, or my assistant Kathy would work with Kathy here, and because I think it would be much more effective for this resolution to go from the county to the governor, to the chairs of the higher ed committee, to our representatives, to the various other kind of state leaders as well as the SUNY. So we'll get that list and we'll work with you in terms of just getting it out.
Carl, thank you very much for coming tonight and your report. Sorry you had a tough drive down, and we hope it's better on the way home.
Not at all. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank
and for
you
your
so
approval
much.
Of our and support of our base aid rate this year. Let's hope it works.
I'm going to turn to Megan McDonald. Sorry, we're going to suspend long enough to put the screens down while she's setting up. Good evening.
Thank you for having me. And on a wintry night like this, home is certainly a warm and cozy thought. Unfortunately, we know that it's a challenge for many in our community. And so we have underway the county's housing needs assessment. And as part of that, I think hopefully you've all heard by now, we have an online housing survey going on now through Monday, February 22nd. And this is an opportunity for local residents, students, and commuters, anyone coming into our county, whether they live here or are working here and living elsewhere, to provide a little bit of direct feedback and input about their housing experiences, whether good, bad, or ugly, the challenges they may have faced, to give us a little snapshot of their housing needs and a little bit about them as well. And so this is being used to, along with other data gathering and research, interviews and such that are all part of the needs assessment, to develop the overall assessment, which will include a projection of our housing needs going forward the next 10 years as well. So I have, hopefully you've seen some posters and emails and things going around. We're up to over 4,000 responses online so far. We also have some hard copies that are available in places like county offices that serve the public, GIAC, Lifelong, the library, places like that. We're taking any requests. If you hear of anyone who needs any sort of assistance, might need a hard copy if online doesn't work for them, you're welcome to put them in touch with the planning department or myself directly. And I'm happy to answer any questions, but also to keep things brief in the interest of time. I'll just say, if you haven't been there yet, you still have a chance to fill out the survey yourself. And that's kind of when you first open it up. You may have heard, I think, a few of you in our initial launch. We had overwhelming responses, and it slowed the survey down briefly, but we've overcome those challenges. It actually, the silver lining was it really spoke to the importance of housing as a topic in the community. And so if you're going into the survey, you can go forward and back. If you decide you want to change something, anything like that, you can't save your response and come back to it, but if you leave your browser window open and want to come back to it a little later, you can. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Megan. Martha.
But it's, you don't really have to, I mean, it's really quick. I mean, it doesn't take maybe 10 minutes or something. So it's not one of those things where you start it and, I got to leave. And so is Ithaca College or TC3 sending it out the same way Cornell did?
Yes. So actually yesterday, Ithaca College decided the best way to advertise for their community was to use their intercom electronic newsletter, which is emailed to everyone that has an ithaca.edu email address. The stories are also up on their website as well. And we even have wonderful interns in our office, one of whom's with Ithaca College, who's helping share it on social media.
And I was wondering about TCAT buses. Can we get hard copies on the buses?
I'd be happy to talk with TCAT and see if that's possible. And I also want to mention that TC3 this afternoon also sent out to their community and their student life folks graciously posted on their Facebook page, which is pretty popular with the students. So we're anticipating. And also a lot of our other larger employers are helping get the word out. So I think that we can anticipate some more responses across the board.
And I think I saw the chamber send something out. And I hope everybody in this room has filled it out. I mean, really, it takes just a few minutes. And it really should be everybody, whether you're happy with your housing or not happy with your housing, it's important to get a broad sample. So I guess your goal is like 5,000 responses, right?
Once we blew through we're working with a consultant as well, and our first day we blew their expectations out of the water. So now that's been my personal challenge. I'm hoping we get to 5,000, which is probably about five times what they were really expecting for a community our size. And I think also along with that, it's not just the number of responses, but trying to make sure that it's a diversity of people in our community and that we're really representing folks that are on all different pieces of the housing spectrum. Thanks.
Anything else for Megan? Dooley.
Are you carrying any paper copies with you?
Of the survey itself? I've actually got some down the stairs if you'd like some hard copies. I can run them back up. I do have with me, if anybody would like any, some handy-dandy posters with the address for the survey that you can tear off if anybody, they've been posted around, but I can provide some. And I'd be happy to bring up some hard copies.
Anna?
Can you remind us of the date that it closes again?
It closes, so it's through the day on Monday, February 22nd. Let me go back to the...
Carol?
And the other question was, do you have any preliminary analysis on whether we're on track with the diversity of responses?
Yeah, so just with what we've gotten so far, we're starting to clean up some of the responses to make sure we get rid of any duplicates or things like that. So far, the majority of people, so we've got about 62% are people that are living within the county. We've had a heavy response from Cornell. They were kind of the first big advertising blast. So we'll see. Right now, students and Cornell employees are about 62% of the total responses. But since the advertising for Ithaca College and TC3 really started more this week, I think that's going to be changing. I will say we also have had a pretty good response from county employees as well and other employers, and actually people that are working from home for themselves or not listing their employers too. And so far we've got a little bit more representation from homeowners. The renters, sometimes they're a little harder to reach, but we're talking with the Landlords Association and others to see if we can reach out to tenant lists and things like that.
Thank you.
Carol?
Did you do the outreach to the neighborhood associations? I'm seeing reminders every day on our neighborhood association to fill, or one of them, to fill this out. And I was just wondering, before I could get to it.
I can't take credit for all of that. We also used resources such as the Chamber, the Human Services Coalition listserv, all of you. It's actually been tremendous. I've been shamelessly promoting as much as I can, but it's great right now that as I encounter people I haven't talked to directly, for them to say, oh, we've already printed out the poster off the website and already taken the survey and sent out to our colleagues and things like that. So I think really the word's spreading, you know, much farther through the community than I could do on my own.
But so I'm asking, was there any or could there be any systematic outreach, you know, to a listing of all neighborhood associations and community newsletters throughout the county, you know, the Lansing community and the Enfield community,
right,
and the each city?
We reached out through the municipalities themselves, through supervisors, clerks, and such, through those email lists that we have, but not directly to the neighborhood groups.
Could you?
So,
would you?
Yeah, I'd be happy to try to assemble. If anybody wants to send contacts or lists, I know different lists work in different ways, where some you need to be a member or things like that. So if anyone has, I'm happy to reach out. Or if you'd like to and would like any sample text or things like that to share with groups that you might be part of, too.
Maybe you could share the sample text with Kathy Covert, who could send it out to each of us, because collectively we cover the entire county. So if we each send it to our neighborhood associations or community associations, that would reach everybody.
Definitely.
Anything else for Megan? Megan, thank you for coming. This is an exciting thing that we're doing, and we look forward to hearing the results.
Yeah.
Martha?
And just, people should know that you can enter by filling it out. You're entered into a drawing for one of three $50 Ithaca Downtown Alliance gift cards. So it's better odds than Powerball.
And you're not obligated to join, but if you'd like to enter the drawing, you're welcome to.
Thank you. Do we need to put the screen? Jay's going to talk to us next. You need the screens, Jay? Let's put the screens up. Jay Franklin is our Director of Assessment. Jay?
Well, thanks. Since I'm here, I might as well give out my yearly reminder for people to reapply for their real property tax exemptions. We have about 1,000 senior and enhanced star applications still outstanding for the March 1 deadline. That may sound like a lot, but based upon the last 14 years of history, that's right in line. It's amazing how creatures of habit people are and when they apply. But I've run out of hair to pull out, so I don't really want to wait. I don't really want to wait until March 1st. So this week, Chairman Lane will be sending out phone calls to all 1,000 people who haven't responded.
Dial every one of them, right?
Yep, he's going to do it all within about 3 minutes. So we'll send out automated phone calls to those who haven't applied. For those email addresses we have online, we'll send out an email for them. You know, I get about 100 thank yous and one why did you call me? So I'll take those odds and any day. So, you know, if you know of anyone who hasn't applied, we'll take it by fax, email. We actually started texting email applications last year as well. So however someone can get an application to us, we'll take it. So it's for senior, low-income disability, ag land exemption, parent with grandparent exemption, really just about any exemptions out there. If people don't know what they need to do, call our office before March 1. So thank you.
Thank you, Jay. Any questions for Jay? Thanks very much. For my report tonight, I'll just mention that yesterday, you may have read in the paper that our United States Senator Charles Schumer came to Ithaca briefly to announce progress on the truck study group proposals and the study that was done by federal funds to the New York State Department of Transportation. It was mighty cold, I can tell you that, on the Commons yesterday in that wind. But he arrived, and he told us that he's been working to get about $40 million in aid to New York State DOT, that some of which could be used, if this is appropriate, for the recommendations in the study for improvements at the east end of the commons, such as barriers, signage, other kinds of things that we would hope would help the truck traffic down there. It's quite interesting, while we were waiting for Senator Schumer to arrive, and the cameras from the various media outlets were set up there facing up State Street, down comes a large tractor trailer. It was a flatbed, empty flatbed. It wasn't anything dangerous, but it had a terrible time making the turn. It came down and turned north on Aurora Street rather than taking the tuning fork and going along Seneca Street. But it was quite interesting to see the maneuvers it had to go through just to make that turn. So that's part of the study, looking at that intersection, and I think it's an important thing as we move forward. I personally want to see the truck group work on some other issues, such as how can we step up enforcement of truck safety in Tompkins County. I personally, this is one of my goals, would be to see Tompkins County listed on the maps out there as, if you're going to drive through Tompkins County, you better have a truck that's not overweight and which is has the safety equipment and its records are up to date, and it's the kind of truck traffic that we want to come through the county properly, with the properly inspected for safety. And so that's a goal we could move toward. Hopefully Assemblywoman Barbara Lifton will be setting up a meeting on that in the near future. The other thing, I have some that's all I have today. I was just going to talk about Senator Schumer. Let's go to reports by the county administrator first. Joe Mariana. Carol.
Ask a question first. So was he talking just about the Tompkins County, the Ithaca situation, or is he doing a tour throughout upstate New York?
He had been in Fulton County, and then he had been in Onondaga County, and then he was finishing in Ithaca yesterday, and I think he was heading back to Washington. Joe?
Thanks, Mike. I just have a couple of items in my report tonight. I'll get the bad news over with first. We have now received the bids for the Pine Tree Road Trails project. This is a project that has had a number of challenges along a very long life, and we've encountered another challenge. The bids came in about $190,000 beyond where the engineer's estimate was, which means that it's about that amount over budget. This is a project that we have increased funding for over the past 5 or 6 years, including our partners. We have partners in this project, Cornell University, the town of Ithaca, and the county are all partners, and we have substantial state and federal money behind this too. Cornell is already in this for $400,000. That's double its original commitment. The town is in for $70,000, also double its original commitment. The county is in for almost $200,000 right now before this increase. So we are looking at options. Jeff is trying to find additional sources of support for the project. We've alerted partners to our situation, and we have some real decisions to make on this project in the near term. We have to decide what we're going to do, because this project is on a schedule that is based on kind of the Cornell schedule. We're going to have to shut down Pine Tree Road for a period of time, and it's important that it's shut down at the right time so we don't create a lot of problems in traffic. So in terms of our timeline for decision-making, it's near term. So we've talked to Mike and Dave and Jim, the two committee chairs that will have an involvement in this, and certainly Mike, just to get a sense of kind of what the schedule might be to look at it. We will try to bring this to F&I, I believe, at your next committee meeting. At this point, there's not a recommendation from staff, although I think by the time we get to committee, we will have a recommendation, if only to provide a frame of reference to the committee and ultimately the legislature to make a choice. But it is over budget. It's, again, a little less than $200,000. And over the next few weeks, we'll be bringing this to the legislature for a pretty important policy decision. The other items I have are much easier and shorter. If you have any question on Pine Tree, I can try to answer those tonight, too. Second item on my list is a very easy one. Paula wants me to remind you that at your next meeting, it's your annual compliance training, something that we have to do. So she'll be providing your training at your next meeting. That'll be our presentation at your meeting in a couple of weeks. The third item, which is the easiest of all to talk about, you've all seen the note from me, I think, about a new communication effort that will begin on March 2nd. I didn't give it this name. Whoever did was much more clever than I am. It's called A Cup of Joe at Joe. It's coming out of the steering committee that grew out of the climate survey that Leslin and Paula and several county staffers are involved in. And our goal is to really promote communication at a small scale so we can really listen and talk to each other. And so we're going to be doing weekly meetings with staff. The goal is maybe 12 people at a time. You don't want too many. You don't want too few. We think a dozen or so is a good number, which means it's going to take over a year to get to all of our employees, but we've already put a schedule in place that will allow that to happen. The goal is a conversation. It's not to, I promise them, I think you saw that I wouldn't do a PowerPoint. It's really, and Carl talked about a listening session earlier, it's really mostly to listen. Hear what's on the mind of employees, hear what ideas are, hear what they think about how we should set goals and try to achieve them. So, again, the first one will be on March 2nd and then every Wednesday morning thereafter. And I'll keep you posted on how those go. And that's my report.
Questions? Dooley, is your hand up?
Sort of, yes, thank
okay.
you. It's not so much a question as a reaction to the Pine Tree Road news. Cornell is probably the biggest beneficiary of this project, in my opinion, and I really hope that they will step up and cover it if they want it. I don't feel that we need to keep putting more money into it. That's just an immediate reaction.
Carol?
I just want to remind people that that was exactly the case that we made to them when it was... There was a reason that it became over budget by a larger amount last time around, and they did step up for the entire amount. So it would be pretty hard to go back to them now. And that was under another president, and it was just before Tom Lavigne, who'd been working with us for a long time, also left. So we'd be starting from ground zero on that and having already made that case. So I hope that you and Jeff will look for other solutions as well. And people should realize that when we first started talking about this, how many years is this? I mean, and what percentage would you expect construction estimates and bids to come back more for each year that we've put it off? So a certain amount of that is just time frame. Our original estimates were 3 years ago? 4 years ago? It's a long
time.
Maybe
6 years ago. This is one of the first things that I was involved in, so it's 6 or 7 years ago.
Rich?
Joe, since I'm new to this, where would be the best place to go to see the plans? Who has those?
Jeff Smith would have them. I can certainly provide those to anybody who wants them. And I'll make a note that I'll have Jeff... I'll have him reach out to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
I'd love to see those, too, since I'm new to this.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Before I move to Jonathan, thanks Kathy and Michelle, reminded me I need to make chair's appointments to the Corrections Union Contract Negotiating Team. And those are James Dennis, Peter Stein, Joe Mariana, Amy Guerrera, Kenneth Lansing, and Brian Robinson. Jonathan Wood is our county attorney.
I don't have a report, but I want to add a real estate matter to the other matters that are on for executive session.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have a report, but I wanted to mention that we have a real estate matter to add to the executive session.
All right.
In addition to the two matters that you had mentioned.
All right. We'll announce that as well. Any questions for John? Rick Snyder.
I have no report for this evening.
County Director of Finance.
And I have no report. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Any questions for Rick? Any other resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? Not seeing any. Let's move to the consent agenda. We have some advisory appointments out of the Public Safety Committee to the Emergency Communications Review and Oversight Committee, Peter Stein. To the Traffic Safety Committee, Peter Stein and Rich John. The Stop DWI Advisory Board, Rich John. To the Advisory Board on Indigent Representation, Martha Robertson. Out of the Health and Human Services Committee, to the Greater Ithaca Activity Center, Anna Kellis. To the Personal Emergency Response Service Advisory Board, Will Burbank. We have resolutions. If anyone doesn't want them on the consent agenda, just ask for it to come off. Resolution A. Budget Adjustment, Health Department, Public Health Preparedness, Ebola Preparedness and Response. That's ID 6123. Out of Facilities and Infrastructure, Award of Bid. That's Resolution B. Tompkins County 2016 Roof Project Facilities Division, ID 6132. Are ready to vote on the consent agenda. Carol?
The GIAC appointment, that wasn't resolved. So, Anna, do you want to?
We had talked about
the conversation about who was going to do it. Do you?
Yeah, well, we had picked several different ones, and I was put myself forward for the diversity.
Just pull that one for now, and we'll figure it out.
I'm sorry, what are we pulling?
Appointments. The Board of Directors.
Gotcha. All right, so then the consent agenda will have the appointment of Anna Kellis to the Greater Activities Center delayed. We'll take that off. All right, so I can get a motion on the consent agenda, please. Leslie McBean Claiborne is our second, seconded by Dooley Kiefer. Are ready to vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Okay, let's go to the standing committees. First up tonight is Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality Committee. I hope that's the name.
Yes.
Martha Robertson is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We haven't met since the last legislature meeting, but we meet tomorrow at 3 o'clock in this room. So in your packet was not, you got the packet with a green cover, and clipped to that were two resolutions that we didn't have when the packet was fully prepared, as well as a sheet from the Early Care and Learning Council. So those are for tomorrow's PDEC meeting. So that should all have been, Katrina emailed all of that to everybody, I think Friday. But in any case, it should be in your packet, in your mailbox. The resolutions, the things that we're going to be talking about are child care, about state response and asking for a state response on federal mandates that are going to be very significant this year. We're going to hear an update from Heat Smart Tompkins. Can hear from Tompkins County Area Development, especially about the Upstate Revitalization Initiative and revisions of the cities from the city on the CTAP program, as discussed at the IDA, actually passed at the IDA. Jim, I think we're past, yeah. So, and then looking at the Planning Department's work program for 2016, which is pretty significant, and everybody says you're going to do all that in 1 year, and that's, yes, that's what they're going to do. So that's tomorrow's agenda, and is there any questions? Happy to take
questions. Thank you, Martha. Charter Review Committee, Julie Kiefer.
Thank you. The Charter Review Committee meets in a week, Tuesday, February 23rd at 3 p.m. It says here we're meeting in the Human Services Building, which is a surprise to me.
I hadn't heard about that. I think that's a mistake, Julie.
Thank you.
We'll be here in chambers. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. In chambers, folks. Questions for Julie? Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim Dennis is chair.
Thank you, Michael. We have a meeting Monday afternoon at 4 p.m. right here. And that concludes my report.
Questions? Thank you, Jim. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslie McBean-Claiborne is the chair.
Mr. Chair, we'll be meeting next Wednesday, 3:30, in the old jail conference room.
Questions?
And we're excited about a cup of Joe with Joe.
The Old Library Committee has not met. Public Safety Committee, Peter Stein.
Public Safety Committee has not met since our last meeting. We will have a meeting on Thursday at the usual time.
Questions?
Coming Thursday.
Health and Human Services Committee, Leslie McBean-Claiborne is chair.
Mr. Chair, we had a brief meeting just before this legislature meeting this afternoon, and the resolution that's on the agenda is what we dealt with. At our last Health and Human Services Committee meeting, we heard from our Commissioner of Social Services more information about the cold weather policy, and so we're quite excited to hear about this authorization of monies to reimburse for what we might spend in the execution of that mandate from the governor. So the resolution on the agenda is what we dealt with this afternoon, and I'm happy to move it.
Resolution C.
Yes.
That's authorization to accept state funding and execute contract cold weather policy, Department of Social Services, ID 6146. Seconded by Anna. Discussion? Ready to vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. Any questions for Leslie? Let's move to Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. Dave McKenna is the chair.
Thank you, Mike. F&I has not met since our last legislature meeting. That's all my report.
Questions for Dave? Thank you, Dave. Transportation Committee. Well, we have met. And we had our first meeting of the Special Transportation Committee. So we're getting started. We had some general discussion. Mike Hall, our airport manager, came in and talked to us about some ideas that he's been thinking about that we might want to be thinking about for the airport, including plans for the industrial site that's being looked at with our study. Also, some ideas of other ways to make the airport even more relevant besides air traffic. Could it be a location for a transportation center, which might include things beyond air traffic, but including bus traffic and other things? Just some things that we began to talk about. We're trying to think globally about transportation in Tompkins County with a lot of changes going on. We also had Fernando de Aragon and Jeff Smith talk to us about highways, highway policies, a little bit about the state and the federal recent transportation bills and funding, just now the you know, where those funds are and what we might have access to is still up in the air. We're waiting for more and more information to come through. At our next meeting, we hope to talk about more about mass transit. We talk a little bit about railroads and our concern about our single railroad here in Tompkins County. And we passed a resolution, which will come to this group next time, asking the state to fund upstate fairly when it comes to infrastructure improvements and transportation, and that there's parity with downstate projects upstate. So you can look at that when that comes along. Glad to answer any questions. Thank you. Government Operations Committee, Dan Klein is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have not met since the last legislature meeting. Our next meeting is Friday, March 18th at 3 o'clock. This is a different time than our usual meeting time. That's just for March that we're changing that time.
Questions for Dan? Thanks, Dan. Boy, you folks are just pushing right through these tonight. We have an individual member filed resolution, Resolution D. Dan Klein.
Thank you. I would like to move Resolution D, resolution in support of early voting and New York State funding of early voting.
Is there a second? Seconded by Martha Robertson. Dan, you want to speak to it?
I do. I have a number of remarks. First of all, I wanted to mention that this did not go through committee, that I'm doing it as a member filed, simply as a matter of timing, because the next Government Operations Committee is not until March 18th. The budget could be passed as early as April 1st. That just wouldn't have left enough time. That's the reason that it didn't go through committee with this. I want to thank our election commissioners, Steve DeWitt and Elizabeth Cree. They helped me a lot with the background and sent me a bunch more information just today, which I'm going to try to let you know about. And the first thing that they told me is that I had the number wrong of states that have some sort of early voting in place. So my first thing is to make an amendment to change line 6 from 32 to 37. Thank you.
Is that friendly to the seconder?
Yes.
Thank you. Let's see, on a separate voting issue, I just read that Green Star Cooperative is moving towards electronic voting. And they cited something which I looked up, which was that the U.S. Census did a question last year in 2014 asking about whether people vote. And for those that didn't vote, they asked them why they didn't vote. And the number one reason was that they were too busy, quote unquote, too busy. So that's one of the rationales behind this, is to allow to make voting easier for residents of Tompkins County.
Dan, I didn't understand the comment about Green Star Cooperative.
Green Star Cooperative is moving towards electronic voting in their
what does that mean?
For their voting procedures for their board of directors.
Oh, internally, you're saying mm-hmm. for that organization.
Yep, and the, and
thank
in,
you.
In their. Writing about it, they talked about this census question that made me look that up. I want to say that this idea of early voting is a proposal from the governor that's in the governor's budget. It's not law yet, so it may or may not come about at all. So that's what part one of this resolution is urging the governor to and the state legislature to go ahead and implement early voting. If it is passed, it won't take effect until 2017. I just want to make that clear, too, that it's not going to affect any of the presidential elections this year. It also does not affect village elections, and it does not affect school district elections, but it affects all the other elections, special elections, primary elections, and general elections in this county. There are 2 to 4 elections each year, depending upon the year. So when we get to the second part of this resolution, which is asking New York State to support the cost of it, it's important to realize that the cost is not a fixed amount, that it's going to change every year depending upon the number of elections that we have. I asked the election commissioners to come up with an estimate of what they thought the cost of Tompkins County would be for early elections. And again, as of today, I just found out a fact that I had not heard before. So in the governor's proposal, it says that for every 50,000 people,
have to have another polling site, which would mean two polling spots for Tompkins County. And as you can imagine, each polling site requires more money to operate it. Well, what I just found out today is that we have 49,500 registered voters in Tompkins County, and apparently it's registered voters and not population, which means that we would only need one site as of today. However, the difference between 49,500 and 50,000 is 1%. There's going to be a lot of efforts at voter registration this year. So, you know, that could change. But as of right now, if the law passed as proposed, we would just need one polling site. The election commissioners estimated that the cost for each polling site would be between $16,000 and $32,000. And they just want to mention again that this is just an estimate. It's pretty hard to get an exact figure at this point. And what that's based on is hiring extra workers to man the poll sites, because the polls are going to be open at least 12 days before the election, 12 individual days for a different amount of hours.
Staff them.
What did I say?
Gender-neutral term would be to staff the sites rather than man the sites.
My apologies.
Sorry.
Yep. Thank you. It would be that would be the cost of staffing the sites. And that there's a little more to it in terms of trying to get a real dollar figure. There are some possible mitigating factors. There's some other bills out there that may or may not affect any of this, and there's also things can be negotiated in the budget. But it's possible that they would actually change the hours that the polls are open. And every time, it would be a shortening of hours. And when you shorten the hours, you have to pay people less. So that could affect it, affect the cost in another way. And also, they expect that there would be fewer absentee ballots if this were to go into effect, and that could also affect the cost. And there were a few other things that could affect it. So they really wanted me to emphasize that the $16,000 to $32,000 is an estimate. So having said all that, that's everything that I needed to say.
Discussion on the resolution. Peter Stein.
Could you explain the rationale of not doing all elections? School committee elections, for instance, I think are often as important as any other voting that we do.
I do not know the rationale. It's just part of the state proposal.
Oh, it's part of the state proposal. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Martha, then Carol.
So you said one polling site per 50,000. So if that's one, and given our geography, it makes sense just to keep to have polling available, voting available at our Board of Elections office. So presumably the costs, the additional costs, are going to be relatively limited. I mean, maybe there would be Saturdays. Are they talking about Sundays, too, or just Saturdays?
I believe Sundays, but limited hours. But the cost, they would not be using their current employees, because their current employees are very busy on the 2 weeks before an election. So these would be hiring poll workers, as we do now for all elections, but the poll workers would be at the Board of Elections office. And you make a good point, too, is that if we go up to a second site, you probably wouldn't just double the number. It would probably be more, because presumably we'd have to pay rent, and there's transportation costs involved as well.
Okay. Well, I think it's really, it's one of those things that really is value added. I mean, I really think for a long time that this is something we should have been doing. I've had the experience of young people coming into the community and being shocked that we don't, talking to me about this, and we being shocked that we don't have early voting. It's not just, we would like to encourage voting during the three off years, not just the presidential year when people maybe make more of an effort. But, you know, our, even in this politically active community, our turnout numbers are nothing to brag about, especially in off years. And I think, you know, eventually people really want to see online voting. You mentioned Green Star. Well, we're not Green Star, but... It's just something that should be available to people, and I think it's really worth the relatively small incremental cost. I hope that the state will help us with the cost, But even if they don't, I think it's something we should support. So thanks very much for bringing this forward.
Anna Kellis. Oh, I'm sorry, I had Carol first.
Go ahead.
All right. She's passing to you, Anna.
Okay. Just a question about line 17. The sentence reads, the New York State should reimburse counties. Was the word should included to give the room for, if they don't, that we will still pursue this and look for it in the budget for the county? Is that just clarification?
Yeah, so the two intentions of this resolution are, one, to support the idea of early voting, and two, that if early voting is implemented, that we're requesting New York State to compensate us for it.
Right. I guess what my curiosity is that the spirit of this or the intention is, if they don't, that we'll pursue in the county to implement this countywide anyway.
If the state passes it, we will do it because it'll be state law, and we'll do it whether they're paying us or not. Does that answer it?
No, I think her question is, if the state doesn't do it, can the county do it on its own? And I'll defer to John, but I'm thinking this is an election, state election law issue. Is that correct, John?
Right. And I don't believe we have any I don't believe we have any power to do it unless it's authorized by the state.
Okay. Carol?
So, thank you. I'm sorry. I should not have been so critical of the language while I was enjoying my man-baked cupcake.
If you could use gender-neutral language, please.
Okay. No, this one was man-baked. Thank you. By Dan, everybody. My question, is what New York State is talking about putting on the table, if they pass this, will it be mandatory for counties to do it? And if so, will they set the number of days, or are they talking about giving us the option because our wording says up to 12 days?
So, yeah, the up to 12 days is unfortunate wording. I took that from the New York State Association of Counties resolution, and I've looked at it more closely, it's not the right wording. As far as I understand, it would be mandated by the state. All the rules would be set down by the state. That's my understanding.
Well, I read this to say that we would support any amount of time that they were talking about, that we'd basically like the idea of early voting, and we're not weighing in on the exact number of days that we think they ought to do it.
That's right. We're referencing the current proposal, which is 12 days.
Okay.
And the reason the up to was in there, just not that it matters a lot, but it's because early voting would shut down 2 days before the election. It wouldn't go right up to election day for logistical purposes. You need to get all the documents out to all the polling sites. So that's why they put up to in there, but it's really not the best wording. But that's where it came from.
I think it's fine wording. So I just wanted to understand if this would be done all over New York State or nowhere, or if it would be state-enabling legislation, and then counties could opt in or not.
Statewide is my understanding.
Okay.
All or nothing.
Okay. I mean, pending other discussion about this, I think I support it. From my understanding of the states, you know, that have had early voting for years, that has been successful there, in all cases with one really oddball situation, which was, you know, one of the candidates dying before the election, with some discussion about what would happen and a little confusion about what would happen or what should happen with the votes that had already been cast. And so I just wondered if you'd heard, and that's such, you know, an unusual situation for somebody to die in a particular 12-day period, and it could happen just with regular balloting as well. We would still have people on the ballots, and I think that has happened in other elections.
Right. So I've heard one or two people mention this, that it, if you cast your vote early and then something changes significantly, you can't take your vote back, which is true. But as you point out, the ballots are already printed and will not be changed. And people can now vote absentee ballot for, I believe, like a month beforehand. Those votes cannot be taken back either. So, yes, there are some unusual circumstances where something could go a little wrong, but that already exists to some extent.
All right, I have...
So my question about that was just, you know, was, did New York, State, have you heard any discussion about oddball situations like that and what the state is talking about, stipulations for anything like that?
No. You know, my guess is that the laws that are in place right now would apply, which deal with that scenario.
Thank you.
I have Will, then Rich, then Dave. Will is passing. Or says no. Rich?
Dan, I think this is really good. Thank you for your work on it. I just note that since we're so close to that limit where we'd have to open up a second site in Tompkins County that really doesn't fit the geography of our county, I note to Jonathan, I think the issue you and I had discussions about of trying to clean up stale registrations off the rolls is ripe to come back to you.
And I did talk to the Board of Elections about that. I'll get back to you.
Yes. Thank you. Good. So, yeah, Rich, you pointed out a good point that the geography of this county is such that if we do have one polling site at the Board of Elections, there's no obvious spot for the second one that's fair to everyone else. And so if this comes to pass and there has to be a second polling spot, that's a question we'll have to answer. But that's a couple of ifs away.
We have Dave and then Dooley. Did you want to speak? All right, Dave, Dooley, and Jim. Then can we get to a vote?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that I'd be in favor of this with one exception. I think it should be only if it's a funded mandate. In other words, I don't think the county should have to pay for it. If the state wants to open it up, that's fine. I don't have any problem with that as long as they want to pay for it.
Are you suggesting an amendment?
Yes, I am.
Okay, where would that go?
That's what I hear. Carl Hanks could
probably help. If you combine the first two resolves, you get something.
Yeah, perhaps by combining the first two resolves, we might be able to.
Could I offer you the wording?
Sure, go ahead.
Keep the first resolve to enact early voting in New York State if and only if the governor and the state legislature agree to reimburse counties for the added cost of this new mandate.
Wait, sounds good to me.
Can I offer
a
potential other word?
Well, let's see. Let's see whether it has a second first. Dave's Jim is seconding it. Carol?
Can I offer a friendly change to that, although I don't support the concept, but it certainly would be simpler to say to enact and fund early voting in New York State.
And take out the second resolve?
Yeah.
I don't know that we have Dave's.
I think that would be friendly.
Would that be friendly? All right. Friendly to the seconder?
Jim?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So that we now have a proposed amendment on the table. Are we ready to vote on that?
I have a question.
Carol?
I have a question. So how much does the state currently fund towards elections for at the counties?
I do not know the answer to that.
So, I don't believe they fund it at all. I think that's solely our responsibility now.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, Dave.
Joe, can you answer that?
Oh.
That's correct.
Yeah. So if that's now our responsibility, I'm having trouble understanding the mechanism by which the state, I mean, would they then would have to build an entire infrastructure to do that. So I'm not sure if it's...
I just don't think another unfunded mandate is the thing we want. Okay, I think voting, you know, having an extended time to vote is nice for people that cannot get to the polls for whatever reasons. But, you know, if given that, it's going to cost taxpayers in Tompkins County a lot of money to support this if the state doesn't pay for it. So I think if they want to change the rules, they need to pay for it.
So can I respond to that? So as I understand, this will cost the taxpayers about an additional about $8,000 an election, for which we now pay tens of thousands or more per election. And it's hard to talk about just the amendment without talking about my support for the – well, if the reason to support the whole concept of early voting in a bipartisan way is to just get people out to the polls, no matter what your perspective, it's just voting should be easier. It shouldn't be one day that you may or may not have to be at work extra that day or whatever. So for me, if it's a responsibility that the state we're already paying for, it would make more sense to me to ask them to pay the additional. But I don't see this in the same light that I see a mandate from the state to do something. We hold elections. It is a local function. So I'm not sure I support the amendment.
Any comments on the amendment? I got Martha, then Peter.
I agree. In the perfect world, yes, this would be funded by New York State. But it is true there'd be a new bureaucracy you'd have to set up. And at the end of the day, these things all. This is why they have three men in a room. They negotiate. Okay, if you want us to do, you want us to pay for elections. Well, then we're not going to pay for indigent defense. And you know, I mean, it really is out of one pocket or the other for us. So, I think it certainly weakens our case if we say, well, we only care about this enough if you'll pay for it, New York State. So, I'm happy with the language that says, you know, that the state should reimburse us, you know, for this mandate. But I also am quite happy to say this has value to us. It's already a local expense. We cannot improve this system on our own in this way. We need the state to make a consistent law around the state for when voting happens. So I think that we have much bigger fish to fry when it comes to unfunded mandates, and I wouldn't stand on ceremony on this, and I would like to pass it as it is.
Peter?
Never occurred to me before, and I'm puzzled by something. We have a system of early voting called absentee ballots. The problem is that you have to swear that you're not going to be here during election day. But why wouldn't it be just simpler to change the language to say that anybody can vote in an absentee ballot whether or not they're going to be absent? Wouldn't cost anything. Am I missing something? You understand what I'm saying?
I think we have an amendment on the table to a resolution that's been offered regarding early voting, and I don't know whether we can go into what the state might have proposed at this point, but I don't think we can change what we're talking about tonight.
Probably. I could introduce this as another amendment, and I won't do that. But I'm sort of curious whether anyone has a quick answer to that.
I have no idea.
Well, yeah.
Dan?
Sure. My quick answer is I like the idea, but it was not the one proposed by the state, so we'd be trying to get the whole state to change, which isn't going to happen.
All right. I'm getting confused about where we are. I just want to say we're beyond time for the break. I don't know how much longer you folks want to go on talking about this issue, but we do have an executive session. So I'll go back to the folks that want to talk on the amendment.
We move the question.
Point of information that you asked for, if somebody has a quick answer about the difference. It's just when the votes get counted. If under this system they get voted on election, counted on election day, and absentee ballots don't get counted till after election day.
Rich?
Move the question.
You're calling the question? Is there a second for calling the question? Seconded by Anna. Ready to vote on calling the question. All those in favor of calling the question, please raise your hand.
This is on the amendment.
On the amendment. Is there those opposed, please, on the amendment? Let's vote on the amendment. Does everyone know what we're voting on?
Please repeat it.
Kathy, help us.
We're adding to the first resolve after New York State. to enact and fund early voting? Okay. And then remove the second resolved.
All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Those opposed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Who are we missing? Peter, I don't think I caught. You're opposed, so that's 7. So the amendment fails. There wasn't 8 votes. So we're back to the original motion as proposed.
Move the question.
Oh, come on.
The question has been called.
You had listed me as one of the speakers, and you keep not calling on me.
Rich, would you defer to let Dooley speak on this, and then we'll come back to you. Dooley?
Thank you. I have an amendment, which I'd like to offer. Resolve further that the alternative of allowing voters to acquire a no-excuse absentee ballot, either in person or by mail, and return it on or by election day or postmarked by election day, as is done in Maine and Maryland, makes sense. Although counting absentee ballots will cost money, it should certainly be less than staffing multiple polling places for up to 12 days. So that's my amendment. It calls for no excuse absentee balloting.
Is there a second for the amendment? Seconded by Peter Stein. Discussion, Martha Robertson, on the amendment.
Well, Julie, it seems it contradicts the whole rest of the amendment, the whole rest of the motion. I'm opposed to this. If you had put language in that said both and, then I might support the amendment. But this sounds like you're saying we should do this instead of early voting. Which
this is
makes
an alternative.
Yeah, that makes no sense in a resolution where we're calling for early voting. So, by the way, the whole idea is that absolutely absentee ballots should be available without having to make an excuse. But the point is it's still a two-step process. You have to go request it. And then at least right now you have to get an application. You fill out an application and then you get your ballot. It's a pain in the you know what. And it maybe could be made easier, but the idea of convenience is you just say, oh, I'm out doing my errands. I'm going to stop at the Board of Elections, and I'll be done. And I think that's the whole point of this. And as Dan said, we don't have a proposal at New York State, from the governor or anybody else that says anything about no-excuse absentee ballots. So I think your amendment would just undermine the intent of the rest of it.
Julie?
The count of 37 states having early voting counts those states that allow no excuse absentee ballots. So it's not clear what that number actually that they gave you from the Board of Elections refers to. The idea that this is an alternative and the state should consider it because of the monetary considerations seems reasonable to me. It doesn't contradict your strong desire to see early voting, Martha. It's just part of the alternatives that the county could support.
It may just be because I'm listening and not seeing it in writing, but it sounded the way it was written as if it contradicted the rest of the resolution.
All right. We're ready to go to vote on Dooley's amendment to add the language regarding the no excuse absentee ballot. To this resolution having to do with early voting. All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. 1, 2. Those opposed? That's everyone else. So now we'll go to Rich.
Move the question.
I have the question. I'm calling the question. Can we just go to a vote, folks? Do we need to do that? All right, let's just vote. This is on the main resolution. All those in favor, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Those opposed? 1, 2, 3. That's 11. We're missing. Less than left. I'm sorry. Okay. So that passes. Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, everybody.
All right. Let's take the minutes. Someone want to move them? Martha, seconded by Anna.
Can I have a question about the minutes?
Go ahead.
It's of Kathy Covert. I called you about several changes. Were those manifest changes, or do I need to move them?
No, I was considering them manifest errors.
Thank you.
Ready to vote on the minutes? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? We have one opposed. All right, we're going to go into executive session. I'm going to need a motion, and the purpose of the executive session is threefold. One, to deal with collective bargaining. Second, to deal with personnel matter. Third is to deal with a real estate matter. So I need a motion. Who did that? Anna's got her hand up. Is there a second to go into executive session? Peter, all those in favor of going to executive session, please raise your hand. We will come back after executive session. We don't expect to take action. Is that correct, John and Joe?
That's correct.
When we come back out of executive session. All right. Thank you. We'll take 10 minutes while we shut down.